Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama set to outline new military offensive against Islamic State. And Ukraine's president, separatist East will stay part of Ukraine. I'm Joe Palca, reporting from Washington. United States President Barack Obama is set to unveil his plan for an expanded American military effort against Islamic State militants in the Mideast. Mr. Obama is giving a primetime television address Wednesday night to describe the threat of the insurgents to U.S. national security and how he plans to combat it. With more from the legislative branch on Capitol Hill, here's Michael Bauman.
As the president prepared to address the nation, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid urged colleagues not to prejudge Mr. Obama's message.
Wouldn't it be a good idea for us just to stand back a little bit and see what the President of the United States has to say tonight? Let's allow him to speak to our country, to our fellow citizens, and lay out his plan.
Lawmakers are keenly aware that many U.S. voters are war-weary yet alarmed by Islamic State radicals. Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
We're tired of sending our sons and daughters potentially to die in distant lands. No one wants to see an extended engagement in Iraq.
Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
From Baghdad, this is Secretary of State John Kerry.
The United States and the world will simply not stand by and watch as ISIL's evil spreads. We all know, I think we come to this with great confidence, that ultimately our global coalition will succeed in eliminating the threat from Iraq, from the region, and from the world.
This is VOA News. By the way, VOA's coverage of the president's remarks will be streamed live at voanews.com. Our coverage begins at 0:30, the Universal Time. Again, that's 0:30, Universal Time. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says he will submit a bill to Parliament next week, granting parts of the separatist East greater autonomy, but keeping them part of the Ukraine. Mr. Poroshenko announced the move at a cabinet meeting on Wednesday. He promised special status to some areas of rebel-controlled regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, but he rejected any talk of federalization or total independence. President Poroshenko said, "We will not give up to anyone the issue of the sovereign structure of our state, the issue of independence, and the issue of territorial integrity. We will remain a united state." Last week, Ukraine's government and the rebels agreed to a ceasefire that appears to be holding for the most part, despite some violations. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is urging Afghanistan's two presidential candidates, Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, to agree on a national unity government. In a statement Wednesday, Mr. Ban appealed to the two rivals to reach the agreement in accordance with the commitments they made 2 months ago. Mr. Ban said this is a pivotal moment for Afghanistan and that a genuine partnership is required to address Afghanistan's many challenges. In a deal mediated by Secretary of State John Kerry on July 12th, the two candidates agreed to a UN-supervised audit of the country's disputed election. Pakistan's military says its warplane struck three hideouts at a Taliban stronghold near the Afghan border, killing 65 suspected militants. Hideouts say the airstrikes early Wednesday targeted militant hideouts in the North Waziristan tribal region, where the military has been conducting a major offensive in recent months. China is sending hundreds of troops to join the UN peacekeeping force in war-torn South Sudan, where Chinese companies have major oil interests. Comments from China's foreign ministry on Tuesday followed a report in the Wall Street Journal that said China was deploying troops to protect South Sudanese oil fields and the Chinese workers and installations around them. Rescue workers in Indian-administered Kashmir continue efforts to evacuate thousands of people left stranded by some of the worst monsoon flooding the region has seen in decades. More than a week of heavy rains have led to floods and landslides, which have washed away houses and bridges, killing at least 450 people in both India and Pakistan. And Chinese nuclear regulator has given final approval to restart two reactors shut down following the Fukushima nuclear meltdown 3 years ago. The Nuclear Regulation Authority said Wednesday that the Sendai power plant in southwestern Japan could reopen, although local approval is still needed. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The International Committee of the Red Cross warns hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan are facing starvation and are in urgent need of international assistance to survive. The ICRC is appealing for an additional $19 million to cover some of the war-torn country's massive and growing humanitarian needs.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, U.S. President Barack Obama is set to unveil his plan for an expanded American military effort against Islamic State militants in the Mideast.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, U.S. President Barack Obama is set to unveil his plan for an expanded American military effort against Islamic State militants in the Mideast. Mr. Obama is giving a television address tonight to describe the threat of the insurgents to U.S. national security and how he plans to combat it, possibly by expanding American airstrikes against militant strongholds in Iraq to Syria. Mr. Obama has told key government officials that he believes he has the authority to order an increased military offensive without congressional approval. But he told key lawmakers at a White House meeting yesterday that he would welcome a favorable legislative vote to show the country was united in fighting the militants. In Baghdad, Secretary of State John Kerry said he was encouraged by new Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's naming of a new inclusive government and Iraq's help in fighting the Islamic State. Kerry met with Mr. Abadi at the start of a week-long trip in the region.
The top U.S. diplomat said he was optimistic that the new Iraqi government could unite the country. Mr. Abadi's predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki, was blamed for marginalizing Iraq's Sunni minority and helping give rise to extremists. Hours after Kerry began his visit to Baghdad, Iraqi officials said at least two car bombs exploded in an eastern part of the capital, killing at least 12 people in the country's latest instance of unrest. A White House official said today the president's plan includes U.S. military action and support for the forces combating ISIL on the ground, both the opposition in Syria and a new inclusive Iraqi government. Officials have given few specifics on what Mr. Obama plans to say in the White House address. The president has already ruled out sending U.S. ground forces back into Iraq. VOA's coverage of the president's remarks will be heard here on the radio, on VOA TV affiliates, and streamed live at voanews.com. Our coverage begins Wednesday night at 8:30 p.m. Washington time. That's Thursday at 1:30 Universal time.
Eight minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The World Health Organization reports the death toll from the West Africa Ebola outbreak is nearly 2,300. There have been nearly 4,300 recorded cases in five countries. Liberian Defense Minister Brownie Sumaki complained yesterday to the UN Security Council about a less than robust global response to the region's health crisis. He said the Ebola crisis is devouring everything in its path and Liberia's national existence is threatened as the virus spreads like wildfire. A health official in the Ancona, Italy, says a Nigerian hospitalized with Ebola-like symptoms has malaria, not Ebola. The woman lives in Ancona and recently returned from a trip to Nigeria. In Senegal, a doctor treating Senegal's first suspected Ebola patient says the patient has tested negative for the virus. The patient is a college student from Guinea. He lost several relatives to Ebola and sought treatment in Dakar last month. Medical officers in Senegal are monitoring several dozen others who may be infected. Experts recently predicted the current outbreak could reach 20,000 people within 6 months.
Music. The International Committee of the Red Cross warns hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan are facing starvation and are in urgent need of international assistance to survive. The ICRC is appealing for an additional $19 million to cover some of the war-torn country's massive and growing humanitarian needs. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
South Sudan has largely faded from the international headlines and become one of several silent or forgotten crises. But for the International Committee of the Red Cross, there is nothing silent about the tragedies affecting the estimated 1.2 million internally displaced people, as well as the 440,000 South Sudanese who have taken refuge in neighboring countries. The humanitarian agency says hundreds of thousands of those displaced are living in camps or temporary settlements, with many in remote locations far from services. The ICRC's head of operations for East Africa, Eric Markley, says the organization needs an extra $19 million to make sure these South Sudanese do not starve.
Basically, to ensure their survival for 150,000 people that will be served, we have forecasted that they will not be able to be self-sustainable in the months to come. We want to make sure that these ones at least will not die of malnutrition.
The UN Children's Fund reports nearly 250,000 children are suffering severe acute malnutrition. The agency warns as many as 50,000 children are at risk of death if they do not receive appropriate treatment. The rainy season, which is due to last until the end of the year, and lack of security are hampering the ICRC's ability to deliver food by airplane or road. It is using airdrops, smaller aircraft, and helicopters, which adds to the expense of the operation. The United Nations estimates at least 10,000 people have been killed and many wounded since fighting erupted between the government and rebels in mid-December. Eric Markley says Red Cross specialized medical teams have been operating from the beginning of the conflict.
We have four surgical teams that are flying from one place to another. Where there are needs. We will be very close to 3,000 surgical interventions since December. It's a significant operation and a significant figure.
One of the agency's major activities in South Sudan is the protection of civilians and prisoners in areas of conflict. Markley says the ICRC has received permission from both warring parties to visit places of detention, and its staff is visiting nearly 4,000 detainees. He says the ICRC provides food, water, hygiene material, and some medication to prisoners from time to time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, China is sending hundreds of troops to join the UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan, where Chinese companies have major oil interests. Comments from China's foreign ministry yesterday followed a report in the Wall Street Journal that said China was deploying troops to protect South Sudanese oil fields and the Chinese workers and installations around them. Responding to reporters' questions, foreign ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying made no mention of oil or Chinese companies, saying China's goal is to strictly follow the mandate of the UN Security Council and promote construction of the region. Hua said China has already deployed 1,800 peacekeepers to South Sudan, while a spokesman for the UN mission in the country, Joe Contreras, said Beijing planned to send 700 soldiers, none of whom have arrived. There was no immediate explanation for the discrepancy.
Libya's parliament has found a new place to escape the fighting between rival militias. Some members are now on a Greek ferry that's docked in the eastern port of Tobruk near Egypt's border. Since last week, about half of the lawmakers and their families have been living on 17,000-ton ferry, the Elros. The remaining parliamentary seats remain unfilled. The ferry is defended by a small flotilla of Coast Guard vessels and some pickup trucks mounted with anti-aircraft guns. When it's time to meet, members of the Libyan House of Representatives are driven to a hotel conference room that's located high on a bluff. The UN mission in Libya and Human Rights Watch have reported grave human rights violations during weeks of clashes between Islamist and national militias to control the airport and the capital, Tripoli. Tripoli and second-largest city, Benghazi, are in the hands of rival militias, but the fragile government maintains control of the vast oil fields of the east.
Here in Washington, a congressional hearing was held today on the violence and conflict in Libya. The House Foreign Affairs Committee took testimony on the Obama administration's policy on Libya. Republican Ed Royce is committee chairman.
Libya has become chaotic, violent, awash in terrorist organizations, more militias than we can count. Its porous borders allow for the easy transit of people, of weapons, of money from conflicts across North Africa to Gaza to Syria to Iraq. And you have rival governments now in Tobruk and in Tripoli making competing claims of legitimacy. 4 months of fighting by the militias there, the last 4 months, has seen an additional 250,000 people flee Libya and brought a climate of fear, those are the words of the UN special report, a climate of fear across the country.
Congressman Royce said action must be taken to help bring stability to the country.
We cannot allow Libya to become the Lebanon of the 1970s and 1980s. We remember what happened in Lebanon. We remember how long a society struggles with the aftermath of that situation. And what happened in Lebanon was that regional states played out their feuds at the expense of the local population. And if that's to be avoided, then Libya needs immediate attention. As we will hear today, the administration is pushing all sides toward a political solution. But I don't see this happening without real pressure on the factions, real leverage on those factions.
Congressman Ed Royce. The ranking Democrat at the Foreign Affairs Committee hearing is Ted Deutsch. He said Libya is on the verge of being a failed state.
Fear that unrest inside Libya will not be contained within its borders is permeating the region. The instability has created an environment where transnational extremist groups can easily travel in and out of the country, and porous borders have allowed for the easy flow of weapons and foreign fighters. Following their respective revolutions, Egypt to Libya's east and Tunisia to the northwest have worked hard to resist the pressures of radical militant groups from causing significant unrest and moving their countries backward. But having a failed state as a neighbor in which terrorist groups are free to consolidate and grow and are given free access to significant amounts of weapons and resources is not a reality that either country can accept. So the question now remains, who on the ground can be a partner for the international community? There's no neat division of loyalty among the Libyan people, and it's difficult to determine which parties share our interests.
Congressman Ted Deutsch. The main witness at today's hearing was Ambassador Gerald Feierstein. He's Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State at Near Eastern Affairs. He said Libya's political leaders have offered no solutions to the country's problems.
Libya's new political institutions and leaders have failed to meet Libya's challenges. Despite the efforts of many brave Libyans, as well as the active engagement of the United States and our international partners, too many of Libya's power brokers and militia commanders have rejected principles of dialogue, consensus building, and compromise in favor of pursuit of narrow-minded interests and a scramble for control of Libya's resources.
He said it is in U.S. interest to help remove Libya from a cycle of violence.
We want to see the fighting end and competing factions commit to settling their differences through a process of dialogue and negotiation. In fact, despite the violence, we do see a potential path forward. There are still many in Libya who understand that their country needs an inclusive government that shares power and resources in a fair and transparent way. We are working closely with the United Nations, the European Union, and other European partners to advance a unified approach, encouraging all Libyans to adopt basic principles of nonviolence and commit to a democratic state. We are working to promote these principles directly with Libyans from across the country and the political spectrum. We and our allies also have a number of coordinated assistance programs designed to help Libyans build a secure, democratic, and prosperous state that continues to operate through local staff and existing networks on the ground.
Ambassador Feierstein said the U.S. has gotten U.N. approval for targeted sanctions against those in Libya who undermine the political transition process. The State Department official said the U.S. also is seeking regional support to solve the Libyan crisis.
It's been 20 years since the International Conference on Population Development was held in Cairo. Many consider the landmark meeting's greatest achievement to be the recognition of women's rights and empowerment. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The UN Population Fund says the September 1994 conference linked population and development and focused on meeting the needs of individual women and men. The key to this new approach, it says, was empowering women and providing them with more choices through expanded access to education and health services, skill development, and employment. Secretary of State John Kerry, then a U.S. senator, was a delegate to the Cairo summit.
You know, I remember leading that delegation to Cairo back when there really was a conspiracy of silence on family planning, sexual and reproductive health, and reproductive rights. And a lot of folks back then were very frightened. They were still afraid to talk about the connections between women's empowerment and women's rights and development, let alone to think that we could actually turn the tide.
He says since 1994, the commitments made by nearly 180 governments shows that the tide is turning.
But it's not a done deal, and we all know that. There are places pushing back. There's a tide of resistance to modernity, and we see it playing out not just in the context of women's rights, but we see it playing out in every single respect with respect to opportunity and dignity and the ability of people to be able to share fully in the choices about their lives.
Nevertheless, Kerry says, more lives are being saved and more opportunities are being provided than ever before. Speaking at the U.S. Institute of Peace, the Secretary of State warns no country can progress if it ignores half its population.
From Kabul to Kinshasa to Kuala Lumpur, I have seen with my own eyes the extraordinary difference that it makes when women and girls can decide if and when to have children. When they're empowered, educated, and equipped to be able to contribute to a strong and a stable and a prosperous society.
He says the nations must adopt a zero-tolerance policy on discrimination, violence, and human rights abuses against women and men.
That violence has no place in the 21st century, period. And we're going to continue to do everything in our power to stop it.
Secretary Kerry adds that HIV/AIDS prevention must be part of any approach to development, and that family planning be fully integrated into those prevention efforts. He adds more must be done to provide economic opportunities to what he calls a staggering youth population. In many countries, most of the population is now under age 30. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. In The Gambia, two human rights groups are urging President Yahya Jammeh to reject an amendment to the criminal code. It would increase the punishment for the charge of aggravated homosexuality to life in prison. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch said today the measure would further add to the climate of fear for LGBTI people in The Gambia. Francois Patuel is a campaigner for Amnesty International based in Dakar, Senegal. He explains why the new amendment should be rejected.
The National Assembly passed a criminal code amendment on the 25th of August, and that criminal code includes several provisions which are extremely problematic if you look at international human rights law. The first one, it contains a section on aggravated homosexuality, which could be used to target a category of the population in Gambia that's already being targeted and living in fear because of their sexual orientation, and it increases the sentence that they could be exposed to life imprisonment. So currently, the Gambia, since 2005, had already criminalized homosexuality, and you could be facing a sentence of 14 years in prison if you were convicted with homosexuality. This was already problematic. It is illegal under international human rights law to facing charges because of your sexual orientation. And this new law makes matters worse for gays and lesbians or suspected gays and lesbians in Gambia by increasing the sentence. The problem as well is that the law itself is very ill-defined, or is very vague. The wording of the law is very vague.
Can you give us some examples of what you mean when you say that the law is vague?
Aggravated homosexuality is defined where the offender is a serial offender. So if you're a serial offender, for instance, you could be convicted of aggravated homosexuality. But what does it mean to be a serial offender? And our fear is that this could be used against people that have already been charged for homosexuality in the past, and that the second time that they're charged, they could be facing life sentence. And of course, this is extremely problematic. Another example is that you could be facing aggravated homosexuality charge if you have HIV. People that have contracted HIV and are living with HIV in Gambia are already stigmatized, they're already marginalized, and it doesn't help to further stigmatize them in law. It doesn't help also from a public health perspective, because people may fear to go and seek medical assistance or places where they could be tested for HIV. Because then, if they are homosexuals or if they are suspected to be, then they could be again facing a life sentence. The vague wording and the increased sentence could mean that life for homosexuals in Gambia or life for people that are suspected to be homosexual would be getting a lot worse.
Now, as you say, consensual sex between same-sex adults is already a crime in the Gambia. So then what is the atmosphere like on the ground for people? Are they truly living in fear, those who consider themselves gay or homosexual?
There's definitely a state-sponsored homophobia in Gambia for the moment. The highest authorities in the Gambia, including the president, have made numerous remarks that are homophobic, comparing homosexuality to malaria, or calling homosexuality the worst foe that has happened to humanity, including at the UN General Assembly. These statements by the president, but also by other officials in Gambia, in addition to the very harsh laws that are being passed criminalizing homosexuality, mean that if you are gay or lesbian in Gambia, or if you are suspected to be, then you could be facing either 14 years in prison, or if you fall within the aggravated homosexuality category, life imprisonment. So yes, people do live in fear. In fact, we've had several reports of the charge of homosexuality being used to pressure people in the country. For instance, a landlord may denunciate someone living in their flat as being gay or lesbian just because they're not paying their rent. We've heard reports like this. And there has been arrests in the past based on the sexual orientation. The law and the fact that these laws are applied really mean that people live in fear in Gambia. And you have a lot of gays and lesbians, or people that are suspected of being gays and lesbians, that actually flee the country.
That was Francois Patuel, campaigner for Amnesty International. He spoke with me from Dakar, Senegal.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Chaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.